Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And in this episode, I've got someone who I've wanted to talk to for a while. This is Diana Lind. And if you're into the whole urbanism thing and you're on Substack, you will have probably read some of her publications, The New Urban Order. And she writes about cities in a way that's like really approachable, doesn't dumb things down though. It's a lovely mix of deep knowledge, plain spoken honesty that every time I read it, it just makes me feel a bit smarter about this world. Anyway, in our chat today, we're going to get into all sorts. So we're going to talk about why cities feel stuck in this sort of strange in-between of not what they once were, but not what they really could and need to be. We'll talk about how Starbucks isn't always the villain that people think it is. We'll talk about curbs. We'll talk about zoning reform. And we'll talk about how if you really want to change a city, you might want to start with its schools. Anyway, I think this is a really good conversation for those little nudges that encourages to something bigger and bolder rather than just tweak around the edges of our cities. Without further ado, let's get into it. This is a conversation with Diana Lind. Diana, thank you so much for being up for having a chat with me, because I love your stuff on Substack. It's like, as I've fallen into the world of Substack, I've met or discovered loads of people's great writing around cities, and yeah, yours just like really struck a tone with me because it's so approachable. It's so like easy to dip into without being an expert, but then you can get like the really deep richness of, you know, the subject so well. So I was like, on my wish list of people to talk to, I had you, and you were gracious enough to be like, yeah, let's have a chat. So thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
But I love to get into these things by letting people introduce themselves rather than me do some sort of bastardized introduction. So Diana, like, but can we get started with a little bit about you, your background, and some of what you do?
Sure, yeah. Well, so, you know, right now, I write the Substack, The New Urban Order, which has, I've been writing it for over 2 years now, and really trying to chart how cities are changing after the pandemic. That was sort of like the initial impetus. And I feel like that frame is shifting as more and more time goes on. Mm-hmm. After the pandemic, like the conversation in 2023 felt very different than it does in 2025 already. But my interest in writing about cities has been something that I've been, you know, engaged in for really like 20 years. I started out writing first about architecture and architecture criticism. I wrote for a magazine called Architectural Record. That was my first job out of college. Did architecture and design monographs for a while. But really, I've been also like a long-term independent media person. So when I was in grad school, I started my own magazine back when people published like print magazines. And around that time, I got to know the founders of what was then a quarterly print publication called The Next American City. And we were both kind of publishing these kind of indie magazines. And a couple of years later, I was hired to be the editor-in-chief of The Next American City, which was very much also in a, like a different time for the discussion of cities. It was really kind of an era in the beginning, in the early 2000s, when a lot of cities were kind of gaining in popularity after just, you know, decades of suburban and exurban sprawl. And I was at Next City for 6 or 7 years. We changed the name from The Next American City eventually over time to Next City, covering international cities as well. And going from a print publication to a fully online one. And in between that and, you know, where I am now, I wrote a book called Brave New Home, which is about the history of single family housing in the US and alternatives to it. And kind of, sure, we can talk a little bit more about like what that book is all about. But that came out almost 5 years ago now. So I've been really, I think also more recently focused on issues of housing, because I think that is sort of at the crux of like what is happening in cities right now.
I think it's really interesting you've got that sort of turn of the millennium perspective. The fact you wrote a book on housing that was published just at the start of the pandemic, is that right?
Yes. Yes. Then I handed it in right before the pandemic. So I, you know, there are ways in which it would be a different book if it was a post-pandemic book, but yeah.
And then writing for Substack, on Substack in 2023, like about post-pandemic, I think you have these really interesting inflection points of how like knowing cities are important at a time when people perhaps neglected them, or yeah, the mass perhaps took them for granted, but yeah, then writing about housing just before lots of things change, but also there's lots of things you look back on and go, how did more stuff not change as a result of the pandemic? Like so much of the world just stayed the same for good reasons and bad reasons. So I think
Sorry, I was just going to say, like, I mean, I think one of the things that interests me about all of those different moments are those were like turning points for cities, right? In various different ways. And like, certainly you can find turning points in any of, like in any given year, but I feel like these have been sort of like the highs and lows for cities in a way.
Throughout the course of that, it's very easy to sort of bemoan cities. I think like my starting point in this was, I don't like this, or this is annoying, or this could be so much better. Throughout the course of that, have you noticed a more optimistic take of, you know what, we started doing this then and then things got better? Or like, where do you sit in terms of how are we doing? Because I think it's really easy to like sort of get a bit down about it, and a lot of the writing can be these people are bad, but I think there's actually must be a really optimistic story of what we've done over that course of time.
Yeah, I think that the world of people sort of recognizing that there's so much potential in our cities to be better places that could accommodate, be like more inclusive of a range of, you know, types of people from different economic or social backgrounds and whatnot, like the kind of cities where, you know, we have also thought about like pedestrianizing streets, or we have created innovations in like bus rapid transit, or actually, you know, there are certain US cities that have like really over the past 20 years kind of gone from nothing to a lot. Yet it also feels like we recognize there's so much that needs to be done. And many of the same kinds of issues have been popping up for so long. And it feels like there's not enough being done. So, you know, in terms of building more housing, or, you know, some things that I kind of think about, like the whole smart cities movement, and like, you know, why is it still that like people are driving around cities looking for a place to park? Like, isn't this something that we should have solved 20 years ago? And, you know, why is it that Paris has its like beaches on the Seine, and yet no other city can do anything that seems like remarkably close to that in the US? You know, like, why is it that we like recognize that? So we've seen all these amazing innovations over the past 20 years, and it feels at times like kind of maddening that a lot of other, you know, US cities in particular have not caught up to it. So I, in that respect, I feel like, okay, you can feel frustrated, but maybe not down about cities. I will say, you know, I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Manhattan and like 1980s and 1990s in many ways, like actually experiencing what, you know, the Sex and the City, Friends, Seinfeld kind of popular culture of New York City life. And so there are times when I can feel awfully nostalgic for this kind of cheaper, easier, less cell phone, digitally focused city, and then feel sometimes also disappointed by, like, let's say what New York or other cities have become, right? That they've become more, I think, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but like much more digitally focused and much less kind of spontaneous and interesting to somebody who's just walking around, more chain oriented, or even not even chain, but like private equity funded kinds of places. And so I think in that regard, like, yeah, there are ways that you can feel, again, also disappointed. But like when I go back to New York now, I am just like, I'm astounded by, I know none of the cool restaurants. I know none of the cool bars, like none of it. And I just am, but I also just really enjoy it. And I find that like the city, like there's still so much to explore. There's still so much there. Like, I don't know if I answer your question, but I think it's like, I think it's a mixed bag. And I think that there is sort of like a perennial optimism that I hold that like cities can reach their full potential. And yet there's also a lot to write about being frustrated.
Yeah. I saw something yesterday. Someone had posted a picture of Minneapolis and they were bemoaning that like that's Brooklyn 8 years ago. And now we're just doing the Brooklynification of Midwestern or like secondary American cities. And I think they were, I think in some ways that's maybe like, yeah, okay, bit of copying and losing some soul, but also some of that's really good. And it's that weird tension of how do you not get upset about things that you shouldn't get upset about? And then how do you celebrate the things that, you know what, that used to be, that place used to be a sort of bland back alley and now it's been turned into a place people want to sit and pay for dinner. Like, that's not a bad thing.
Right.
I think there's like a really interesting thing of, and then maybe I can say this as a Brit who's lived in New York City, but I think a lot of Americans look at New York and think, oh, I really like that, or I'm really scared of it. but because I because it's New York, we can never become that. So we'll never be that bad and we'll never be that good. It's not necessarily attainable. So there's almost like different role models that need to be looked at to then get the confidence of here's what we could change, here's what we can become, and here's how we can do things that aren't cloning but are being ourselves. I think there's like a thing in there, and some American cities I think do that wonderfully well, and some I think are still sort of having a bit of an identity crisis.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that cloning issue is real, where you feel like something doesn't actually feel authentic to the place mm-hmm. that you're in. And that can feel actually pretty sad. Like, why am I in X city and it just doesn't feel right? Like, it doesn't feel like it is actually representing anything from that place. And I don't know whether that's necessarily anything new. Like, I think that has been going on for a while. I think the difference is that it might once have been more like chains felt that way. And now these are kind of expensive restaurants. And it's, you know, they're kind of more sophisticated in the ways in which they're cloning what was in Brooklyn into Minneapolis or whatever. I think, you know, that's just sort of like an unfortunate byproduct of, I think, often like investment works in a lot of places is, you know, whether it's housing or it's retail or it's bars and restaurants, like people want to replicate what has worked somewhere else rather than try something completely new. But that then all the more makes like other neighborhoods perhaps more enticing because they're more authentic and different. Like maybe that's just one part of Minneapolis and it's kind of sad that it's happening in that one neighborhood, but I'm sure there are other neighborhoods that are actually more like local and feel authentic.
I think it stuck with me because I've only been there once, but like, as a Vikings fan, I have like a sort of affinity towards that city. But when I went, I just found it this sort of place of people confident in their own skin, doing their own thing. It was like, obviously you knew you were in America, but you didn't feel like you're in Atlanta or Chicago. It had a character and a soul to it. And I think some American cities just do that so, so well, but almost don't celebrate it. And we talked before we hit record, but like there's the telling the story of it in a way of it doesn't need to be like perfect by the textbook, or it doesn't need to be like, this is the best practice. It's your best practice. It's your way of doing it. I think there's like a really interesting thing there of, I don't know how you tell the story. I don't know how you sell it. I don't know how you make the lessons work, but like, sometimes you just got to get on with it and do it, right? And then it'll sell itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, for some cities, frankly, I'm thinking back to a couple of decades ago. I just remember growing up again in New York. And I remember when our neighborhood got the first Starbucks. I was in college, and I just remember being so mad that Starbucks was invading this neighborhood, which by now has totally changed. I grew up in this neighborhood called Yorkville, and it was a sort of an immigrant enclave, particularly for like Germans and whatnot. And so there used to be like all these German meat stores and bakeries and stuff like that. And then it sort of felt like the death knell was having, you know, Starbucks come in. But I remember talking to a coffee shop owner in the neighborhood and lamenting that the Starbucks was coming in. And he said something that was really interesting to me, which was like, Starbucks made it acceptable to sell a $3 coffee. Like we would like our business is thriving because Starbucks is here. Is it part of the culture? And so sometimes I wonder, you can bemoan the kind of banal gentrification that might be happening in a certain neighborhood, but it can also in certain ways make it safer for other entrepreneurs to have a viable business in the neighborhood too. Yeah. And so it probably is some sort of fantasy that you could create, you know, neighborhoods that are completely devoid of these kinds of chains or things that not, you know, whether they're chains or not, or there's something that looks like it's replicated from Brooklyn or whatnot, but they may also be making it safe for like other, you know, locals to actually have real businesses.
They do this sort of thing of they don't necessarily raise or lower the ceiling, but they raise the floor. Mm-hmm. So like a Starbucks coffee is never going to be brilliant. Sitting in a Starbucks is never going to be the most magical experience of your life, but you probably know if there's a seat, you can pop up in your laptop, plug it in. You can sit there for a while and watch the world go by if you want to. But I think it does this thing of, if you're a coffee shop and you're independent and you sell not very good coffee and you don't have a nice place to sit, Starbucks is going to kill your business. Right. But if you're an independent coffee shop and you sell nice coffee or different coffee and you do it with a different kind of barista and you do it with a better place to sit and hang out, and there's lots of different ways of doing that, Starbucks isn't a threat to you at that point. It's just it maybe keeps you on your toes. But maybe there's like an analogy in there to cities of like there's things that places will do, and you kind of have this homogenization of certain cities. But when you have that, the cities that thrive have to have some sort of character or have to have done something that makes them special for people to want to live in or visit or have an office in or whatever it might be. I think there's that. Yeah. There's something to that, which is we can really easily and there's loads of bad things about chains and homogenization, but there are benefits too.
Well, you know, also even within the like metro area, right? Like that, I think is also another issue, which is just like if the downtown or the urban core is not doing better or something more interesting than say like kind of more, you know, stereotypically bland suburbs, then what's the competitive advantage going to be downtown, which is going to have to be more expensive real estate, you know, like you have to be able to kind of raise the bar also. So I think that's also a factor even just like within the metro area. And it's probably why, frankly, like a lot of downtowns are suffering is they haven't figured out how to like raise the bar.
I used to like have this guilty pleasure of when I lived in New York, if we rented a car in New Jersey and went out to New Jersey or Pennsylvania, stopping at a Target on the way back and doing like a big Target haul and being like, I bought loads of stuff I needed for home and it was half the price of what I'd pay in New York. So I can lug some grocery bags back across the city on the subway after dropping off a rental car. But there's a thing in that. I actually think IKEA do this really, really well. Like they've gone from, hang on a minute, people schlepping out to wherever they're going to go to a big box store doesn't really work anymore. How do we put IKEAs in downtowns and you can get things delivered and you can, so people might go to the IKEA downtown four times a year rather than going to the one on the edge of town once every 2 years. I think there's brands that really get that and they actually then contribute back to the city because the suburbs and the strip mall no longer has this, maybe they damage the suburbs, but maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing because they're revitalizing the downtown and that has a bigger impact. But I think there's things like that that are happening, which it's all about the yin-yang balance, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if also, especially I'm thinking when you mentioned IKEA, I think there was a brand new IKEA on Market Street in San Francisco when I was there. And that was sort of the whole model was like, we could have an IKEA in downtown San Francisco. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that like downtown San Francisco's real estate has become so devalued compared to probably like what it costs to have, you know, IKEA somewhere in, you know, the suburbs in the Bay Area, why not have one downtown? I wonder, just generally speaking, like what happens with all this stuff when most of the shopping starts to move online. Mm-hmm. These are more just kind of showrooms for what people are looking at online. It could get kind of interesting. Like, you know, forget about having like an IKEA that's the whole store. Like, what if you had just, you know, the living room store? Yeah. It was just IKEA's living room stuff, or just the, you know, I mean, like, you could just, I think we haven't gotten to the, right now, almost like we're in this not very exciting part of the digital takeover, if you will, like, where everyone just spends a lot of time shopping online. And then maybe you go into a store and you go into the store to try on some clothes or to feel the fabric of the couch that you're going to buy or whatever it might end up being. And that feels very unexciting. It's, you know, it feels a little bit like worst of both worlds. It could be, there's a lot of other ways it could be a lot more interesting, you know, and I think this is certainly where some retail is going, like much more experiential kinds of retail and things like that. And not to say that I'm like advocating for the digital takeover of cities at all. I'm like very much on the other side of things, but I feel like where we are right now is pretty disappointing in terms of just like, you know, in Philadelphia, some of our prime real estate in the city is digital native brands. And yeah. I find that really kind of heartbreaking to be like, this is our downtown is just has nothing to do with Philadelphia per se.
I think that really ugly bit of, I think a lot of companies don't know how to, I think actually some of them do know. I think some of them are a bit like lazy because it's not simple, but how do you, and some of it's actually just not possible to measure. You have to have the confidence that some things in life you can't measure. But because they want to measure everything, we would rather attribute the ad that you clicked on your phone, that's the reason you bought that dress or that table or that book or whatever it might be. And in reality, like I keep coming back to this of like the UX is actually the place. So the reason I bought whatever I last bought might be because I saw it in a shop window. It might be because I saw somebody wearing it, something similar, walking down the street, and that gave me inspiration. But we can't attribute that very well. And it means that a lot of companies haven't then invested into their storefront. I say this about employers, but like when you get employers shouting about, we want people back in the office 4 or 5 days a week, make your office nice.
Yeah.
And so you don't get that kind of connection to, we can measure lots of things in the digital world. There's things in the physical world that we might never be able to measure, but we don't necessarily know the benefit of them until they're gone. And I think that we're in that horrible bit of cities where, how do you justify going and spending a lot of money on good storefront that might not sell very much directly, but it sells a lot indirectly?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a thing there that, like, I think your point of like, we're in that sort of like boring bit. I think we're in the really, it's the bit that nobody wants to admit they don't know the answer to.
Yeah, you know, I skimmed an article today about how we're, you know, maybe France knows how to do, French department stores will teach America how to have department stores. And this is kind of based off of like the Printemps, like, store that opened up in Manhattan. And it's, you know, this much more experiential kind of department store. It's much more, you know, you're selling goods, but you're also kind of selling an experience, and you're selling, it's like a destination to shop at rather than it being like this pragmatic, you know, we've been so focused on the pragmatic that maybe it's time for a shift on that. And granted, I didn't like get to the conclusion of this, just literally just skimmed past it. But I do think that, you know, that is so much more exciting, and it's part of what, you know, makes people want to shop in person or to do things in person. And I think what you're getting at in terms of like, if you want people to work from the office, make your office nice, I definitely think that that's like really true. And I think that what, you know, we have for a very long period of time not needed to, you know, kind of upgrade the work environment or upgrade the user experience of the city for a lot of people, right? Just because there was no competition, right? You had to come into the office to get a job, period. And now it has dramatically shifted. And at the same time, though, like the economics of that hasn't shifted. So that's like where it's really problematic, right? Where it's like you have fewer people who are going to be coming into the office who need a better experience. And like, how can cities support that? Like when this is not, this infrastructure, the street that you walk down, the safety that you feel on the subway, like that is not being supported by anything. So that is, you know, that calculus is something that I think no one has really quite figured out. And a lot of cities, I think, have relied on philanthropy to kind of improve the public realm. You know, in some cases that has been really successful, yeah. Right? I think I went to Detroit last summer and it was really pretty amazing, like what Dan Gilbert, between his companies and his foundation, have done to invest in downtown Detroit. And it's become this place where, you know, and I was walking around and just lots of people were going into the office, and it was really kind of trying to build this, even if it's just a small village of people who are out and about in person. And there are, you know, murals on the streets and on the walls and, you know, parks where there's, you know, a great spot to get your lunch and all this kind of stuff. But that is not happening based off of just like regular Detroit's, you know, tax revenue, you know, supporting the city services. Right. Exactly. Right. So, yeah, I mean, this is definitely a piece that I have been meaning to write for a long time yet written, but it's really about like, you know, cities do need philanthropies at this point, and maybe they need to be thinking about the sort of return on investment that they're making across the city, in a completely different way, instead of thinking about like specific grantees. Or it doesn't have to be either or, but in addition to funding individual grantees, thinking about kind of a support layer for the city that provides some kind of returns that are spread throughout the city as well.
Yeah. There's a really interesting thing around like funding cities where, and I don't understand this anywhere near perfectly, but you'll get the comparison of, here's how much the mayor of New York has in their budget and what they get in terms of tax take from the city, from the state and from the feds to spend in the city because the city generated more revenue. And then you'll have the mayor of London or the mayor of Toronto bemoaning that, like, basically they're reliant on kind of going cap in hand to the higher order of government to say, can I have some money, guys? And it makes it really, really, like, interesting in terms of what cities can do. And you see, I think the Toronto example is great because it's people want, like, there's lots of demand to build new housing, but housing costs a fortune, so people can't buy it. But one of the reasons it costs so much is the development charges. That's how the city has plugged the holes in the budget. And it worked for a bit. And now it doesn't work because nobody can afford to buy the thing that gets built and the developer doesn't make enough money from it to justify building it. And is that how you fund cities of then becomes the, well, they look at it simply, well, if you don't get these development charges, we can't fund things. And we definitely can't afford to go and make the sidewalk nicer or the train station nicer and things like that. But then suddenly you end up in that sort of, well, then no one comes downtown, no one spends money. So the place that was paying property tax leaves, becomes a digital-only business or just shuts down. And I think that's that funding model of how you pay for cities. And it probably links really well into like housing, where you've written a lot about single family housing and sprawl. I never want to use the word, the density word, but like you kind of need to like contain it and make it work to greater than the sum of its parts and figure out a way of paying for it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you've really hit on an important issue here, which is that the funding models for cities, I'm not sure that they ever really worked, but right now, like, they feel like they're really, you know, they could be in real trouble. And I think in the US, a lot of cities have been able to hold off on the so-called, you know, urban doom loop because there was just so much money given to states through the Biden administration, which then funneled down to cities. You know, so it has seemed there's just been a lot of rainy day money that I think has plugged holes for a while. And it will just be really interesting to see what that ends up looking like in the future. I don't know. You know, it's funny, like, and certainly, like, we're both familiar with sort of the strong towns argument and issues, which is just also like, it's not only an urban issue, trying to figure out, like, how do we support these kinds of economies? And certainly density, I think, is a big part of it because, if you're gonna have expensive real estate and it's not dense, like, then you're really in trouble. But I also think that it kind of gets back to some of the things we were just talking about in terms of people's standards have really been raised. What people feel like they need in order to feel safe in a city, to feel excited enough to do things in person, et cetera, like that has really changed, I think, a lot over the past couple of decades. And it's really expensive. And I think in some ways also there have been, you know, other things that have kind of, in a way, contributed to that. Like sometimes I think in Philadelphia, I used to work at University of Pennsylvania for a bit, and the campus is just so nice, you know, like it's just a really nice campus. The new buildings are gorgeous and well-maintained. And then like you get out into the regular world and like, it's not like that, you know? And I sometimes wonder, it's part of the issue that kids are kind of going to colleges and being in certain other kinds of experiences where like the physical infrastructure has been so nice. And then you're sort of released into the regular world in your 20s. And you're like, this subway station is so disgusting. And it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, no one's paying $40,000 a year to use the subway station.
Nor are there sort of philanthropic donors to the institution putting money into it, right? Like,
yeah.
It's the, like, universities have, colleges and universities have all of that sort of slammed together, which I think it definitely sets your expectations off in a strange way.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, so when I was in Copenhagen a few weeks ago, and then I was in Gdansk in Poland afterwards. But there's a European style of building, really quite pretty. Like, they're not going to be sort of places that tourists go and flock to. But there's a sort of European style of architecture at the moment that's just really pleasant and modernist. Mm. Not in keeping with the, I think Gdansk is the best example of this, of they built lots of new buildings that fit the old buildings that have those like beautiful triangular roofs. But like inside, they've not got any, you have to add the character to them. Mm-hmm. But you sort of look at it and go, is this expensive to build?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that it's one of those things that you touched on the campus thing. It's almost like the campusification of neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And like you don't have really huge, the properties aren't huge, but they're not small. So like you can have an apartment that you can raise a family in. It's not going to be as big as a single family home, but you get all the other amenities of living in the city with it. And it got me thinking of like, how do you get to that? I think a lot of Americans and a lot of Canadians would look at that and go, ooh, like, I don't want to live there. But a lot of Europeans sort of look at it and go, why would you not want to live here?
Right, yeah.
And it's that sort of not selling it based upon the hair-shirtedness of it's the right thing to do to live in a dense neighborhood because it's more economically efficient to serve our public needs. But actually, this is so nice, I'd rather live here than the suburbs. I think there's a really interesting hurdle to overcome that. And again, I don't know how to do it, but I think there's like an interesting contrast.
Oh, that's super interesting. And I would love to see some pictures of what that looks like, because I do think that, you know, people need to see things to actually believe that they want it. Like, I think about that a lot with the sort of starter home issue. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people think everyone wants a 2,500 square foot house. No one wants a, you know, 1,300 square foot house. But when you actually put a really cute 1,300 square foot house out there, it's, you know, less expensive and it's on a smaller lot and it's built nicely, but it's not luxury. When people see it, they actually do want it. And I think that's sort of, I mean, it kind of gets to this issue that we were talking about initially, which is just sort of like the risk of doing something a little bit different. And once people see that, then they will accept it. And once people see that there's a market for it, you know, I mean, obviously, like there are issues in the US that prevent people from building small starter homes that have to do with zoning and that have to do with, you know, the cost of actually of land and all that other kind of stuff. But the point being that, like, I think, you know, even, for example, forget about calling it a starter home. Like, let's just even think of, like, smaller apartment buildings. It's the same kind of issue. I think it's really about piloting stuff that people, that you can show that people actually want. And that can kind of start to build some momentum around it.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying there's a lot of the things that get built in Europe would be illegal to build in most American cities. So there's that whole thing to overcome. But if you think of that, I don't know what they call them. There's a word for it, but like you'll get things where it's like half a block long, six stories high, retail on the ground floor, some basement parking, and then units. Since I kind of lived in one of those buildings in Williamsburg, it's like when North Williamsburg just kind of became. The hipsters had done their job, and then all the developers came in and built stuff. But like, they don't have a lot of charm or character. They're just sort of units that you live in. And I think even that term "starter home" is the sort of it's not terribly aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how do you get the language and the branding of it working right?
Yeah, that's so interesting. No, I don't know that I've really. I feel like, you know, yeah, like starter home, I feel like that has just been used for such a long time. And I guess I wonder what would be, you know, because I think you're completely right. No one wants to be in a starter home when they're in their 40s, right? That sounds totally appropriate if we're thinking about people buying, you know, 28-year-olds who just had a baby in 1970 or something like that, right? Like, but in 2025, when people are having their first child at 38, and that's when they're buying their first home, calling it a starter home kind of feels like a bit of a letdown. And we need to think about something, you know, something else that feels a little bit more aspirational, but that also kind of speaks to the fact that, like, for many people, you know, this may be their first home purchase, and it may not be like a huge home like, you know, people had in the past.
Yeah. And like, maybe you don't want it. Maybe there's so many good things you don't actually spend that much time in your home. But again, you can't tell people that. You have to let them do it. And then they tell other people, well, I bought this smaller home and now I spend all this time doing other things. It's that the communication isn't necessary. It has to be asymmetrical, right?
Yeah. Although, you know, one of the things, and who knows if this will end up being my next book or not, I've been trying to sell it and I'm convinced there's not really a market for it. But I've been writing about how Americans in particular spend a tremendous amount of time in their homes and an increasing amount of time in their homes. People 15 to 24 spend on average more than 2 hours more each day than like their counterparts in 2003. So like people are just spending more and more time at home. And so it also, it's sort of this, you know, impassable situation where people feel like they need to have a place that can accommodate spending increasing amounts of time. And yet we can't, most people can't afford these expansive homes that have, mm-hmm. you know, one room for an office and one room, you know, for guests or working out or whatever it is. And yet if you're not going to the gym, if you're not going to the office, if you are, you know, cooking all your meals at home, like you can see why people feel like they really need to have more space at home.
There's a really interesting thing that you hear it from British realtors, you hear it from Canadian realtors in Montreal and Toronto. I think you definitely get it from New York ones. But they always say that the people who come to me to like, they always have their requirements to like for a home. Like they kind of say at the start, like, yeah, you're not going to get all that. And like, the buyer will be, no, but I have to have all these things. And I went through this last year. I sort of said, I want to be in these neighborhoods in Montreal. I want a period property. It needs to have X, Y, Z. I bought a thing that wasn't in that neighborhood. It's not a period property. It doesn't have X or Z. It might have Y. But I think there's like a really interesting thing there of you kind of have to get people to, for they have to make the decision themselves. The realtor can't just say you're never going to have that. And then the New York version of that is if you've not lived in New York before and you turn up and go, I don't have a washer and dryer, I don't have like much of a kitchen, I can't live like this, and then you realize it's actually cheaper to eat out a lot of the time, and you know what, taking your laundry to get happy to be done for you, it's lovely, it's luxurious, until you desperately want that one thing that you want to wear tomorrow and you can't because it's not clean. But I think there's like that, you can't tell people you will have this and enjoy it. You kind of have to let people get themselves to the place of, yeah, I know I wanted that originally, but I've changed my mind now.
And
it's a hard thing to do.
I think, you know, so much of what we've been talking about is like expectations and human nature. And kind of the way in which, you know, people's expectations for the city, for their home, etc., like they're necessarily changing just by virtue of the cost of living, because of the way, you know, the increasing size and dominance of like the digital economy, all this kind of stuff. And like, and we're just in this, you know, sort of transition point, which I think we've not adequately kind of prepared or talked about, you know, prepared people for or talked about. And I think that like ultimately there are a ton of people who want to live in cities, who want to live in kind of the ways that you describe, like who don't feel like they need a ton of space at home, etc. And probably more people would live that way in cities if it were more affordable. Mm-hmm. But there's also sort of this like chicken and egg issue where it's like, if you can't afford to live that way in the city anymore, well, then you're going to like really enjoy having that washer and dryer at home. You know, like you're going to all the more be like, yeah, I have my own home gym. You know, I think that that's kind of, you have to be all the more excited for all those other amenities.
I'm really fascinated by that because I think you've written a bit about co-living before. Mm-hmm. Co-living is one of those terms of like, I'm British, I don't like the term co-living because it means doing things with other people, and we are sort of genetically allergic to some of those things. So when I moved from London to New York, I was like, something feels off, and it's like people were talking to each other on the subway, whereas in London, even if you're with your friend, you don't talk while you're on the tube. But like, I just found that kind of, the term scares me, but like the reality actually is something that, you know what, I've done that before. That's actually great doing that.
Yeah.
But I think it's like those kind of things of we fall back into the, we build single family homes. And then it becomes like if you ask a kid to draw a home, they'll all draw the same thing, right? Rather than like, what would a house look like if it sacrificed living room space for kitchen space? Or what would it look like if it sacrificed kitchen space for workspace? And I think that's like a really interesting, maybe not sacrifice is a bad word, biased for. Might be like the better way of putting it, but like it's having that, how do you get that space to experiment? And I guess that's coming back to what you said earlier, we're in that sort of place now where we don't have a ton of experimentation.
Yeah, I mean, I think co-living definitely you know, it seemed like it was on such a rise prior to the pandemic, especially, you know, where there was just sort of this generation of people, particularly like younger millennials and maybe like older Gen Z, even depending on like where the cutoff is and whatnot, mm-hmm. you know, people who were in the 2010s who were kind of like, I want to live in the city. I don't need a ton of space and I want experiences over things. So that really had been kind of a compelling and didn't want to have, you know, the friction of having to set up your own, you know, get all of your own furniture and your internet and your phone and your water. You kind of get a co-living situation where you had, you know, just a lease. And or you're paying month to month or whatever it might end up being. And you had a built-in community and almost like wraparound services. And I think that was a really compelling thing for a lot of 20-somethings. And then that industry in the U.S. in particular really died off during the pandemic. Just there was so much consolidation of the different companies that were providing co-living at scale, right? Like, and so I do think that like co-living continues on and is still popular in kind of a fringe phenomenon and an independent phenomenon. But the sort of idea that there were companies that were creating, you know, 500 unit buildings that people would have enormous rec rooms and communal dinners in, that sort of era has kind of ended. And I think, frankly, like the business model never really quite worked, or maybe it worked, but it just didn't work funded by investors who needed like a really strong level of return really fast. Yeah. So
there's a really interesting version of co-living, which continues. It's just people don't like to talk about it. But like a friend of mine owns various properties in a university town. And whenever a tenant leaves, he'll list it. He will get applications from mostly Indian students. And it'll be like 9 of them going, can we rent this 3-bedroom property? And he's like, I want to rent to families. But he's always stunned by the number of people that are like, it's all this underground economy of recent immigrants mm-hmm. that are then, they're doing their own sort of hacked analog co-living because it's all they can afford and they're actually quite comfortable with it. And it helps them get set up in a new country. But no, we don't really like to talk about that because that's more of a market failure than it is something by design.
Well, you know, it's interesting. HotSplit, which is one company in the US that did start off kind of calling itself co-living, and I think it does still call itself a co-living company. But really what PadSplit is all about is creating the most affordable housing out of these smaller, you know, single family homes where they like eliminate the living room or the dining room, turn them into bedrooms. And then all of a sudden what was, you know, a 2-bedroom house is now a 4-bedroom house and you can rent it out pretty inexpensively. It provides essentially affordable housing. So cities that have enabled that, I think have made that, yes, definitely. What they're doing, I think, which is really smart, is making it not underground. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, and there's been this whole conversation about single room occupancy, legalizing it again, because that used to be a huge source of affordable housing in our cities that has been, you know, made illegal. And people don't like it, right? Like they don't want it. They want to say like, we don't want to have SROs. This isn't dignified housing, etc. And then really what ends up happening is that you force more and more people into being homeless, honestly. Yeah. And so like people do need bare bones, affordable housing in order to afford a lot of markets. And some people don't really even want more than that. Like they just want a place, like, especially let's just say somebody who unfortunately is working 2 jobs, right? Like how much they need a place that they can sleep and that is affordable and that is safe. And that they can get into and get out of as they need to. That's what a sort of a single room occupancy or a pad split can offer people. And I think cities that and people that are trying to deny that, I think, are just unrealistic to your point about like what the real underground sort of economy is asking for.
You touch on things like rules there. And I think there's a lot of rules that people aren't aware of that influence how our cities work, how people get around, where people live, etc. Do you see, are we starting to get to the point where you think these are the easiest things to put in, the hardest things to take away? So do you see like change in that happening in American cities where it's actually going to change how zoning works? We're going to change around requirements of what's single stair access or whatever it might be. Are you starting to see us heading in that direction of, hang on a minute, maybe it's the rules that we created for good reasons are no longer fit for purpose. Can we change them?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that is happening. Like, zoning reform is happening in a lot of American cities, and that a lot of cities are really kind of starting to take that seriously as a reason for why less housing is getting built and why housing is so unaffordable and why the math may not work in a lot of places to actually build anything. So I think, you know, the amount, when I look back on when I started my book in 2018 and where we are now, it just feels like we're in a totally different place in terms of the conversation and just how, like, it is a real conversation happening in every city, whether or not their zoning reforms are happening. It's definitely a conversation. Whereas 7 years ago, it really did not feel like it was a conversation in a lot of places. And, you know, whether that is actually, you know, it's interesting to see like where the zoning reforms are actually happening, how it is actually resulting in more housing in certain places, like to get back to Minneapolis, right? They were, that city was really like at the forefront of legalizing pretty much up to like a fourplex in most neighborhoods in Minneapolis. And there are certain other issues around like why more dense housing didn't get built in some neighborhoods. But by and large, people would consider like in Minneapolis to be a miracle in terms of it being able to build more housing, keep prices low. Like, it's had much less price appreciation than a lot of other cities. So I think it is definitely happening. Like, is there room to do more? Absolutely. Are we also starting to see, I think, a little bit of a backlash also even of like people saying, you know, for example, in San Diego, which had the most liberal laws around accessory dwelling units, and essentially people use the accessory dwelling unit laws to build like stacks of ADUs, like apartment buildings of ADUs, that has now caused San Diego to now push back on that and sort of create a less permissive ADU policy as a result. So, you know, you could start seeing some of that in return, but I think we're in like a much better place than we were a couple of years ago.
Where do you think we go now? What do you think changes into the, we talked about being this sort of like, I hate the word messy because all urbanists use the word messy, but we're in this sort of murky bit right now.
Yeah.
Do you like, how do you think we go move forward in the future? What do you think changes? Just so in we can come back in a few years and tell you we're right or wrong. I think in terms of like housing, but like, I think that you start this conversation, well, we start talking about like there's people of, someone will be really into cycling, but they're not so into housing. And then you'll have like more classical urbanists. I think the thing people are starting to recognize now is housing people are starting to connect with cycling people, and transit people are starting to connect with commercial real estate people, and we're getting better at making those connections, even if it's not like someone who's at the heart of urbanism. Like, at least the fringe people understand the thing I'm interested in is connecting that thing over there, and actually this is how we help each other. So maybe not just housing, but if we want to focus on housing, that's cool.
So I think another theme that we've been talking about this conversation is just sort of like this need for transformation and how do we adapt to that? And I've been thinking about writing a post about like, these are the various different types of new roles that cities need in terms of adapting and transforming themselves. And so, for example, I saw that Boston was creating I have to look up what the exact title is, but it was essentially like the director of curb management in Boston, right? And it's just like, that is an awesome new role that we should be having. Like, controlling the curbs of our city will determine like a ton of different issues of like how the city works, right? And that's not a role that a lot of cities have right now, or any, right? I don't know. But so there are a lot of different types of roles where we need people who are empowered to take this transformation forward, and recognizing that it's going to be complicated and difficult and maybe, you know, cross sector and whatnot. Like, you can't just have one person who's like in charge of housing transformation or whatnot. But like, we have to figure out like what those roles are and or what those organizations are or what those funders are and whatnot. I think like that's the critical challenge over the next couple of years is not just thinking about, you know, one-off innovations, more like, how does this play into this larger discussion about like how life is being transformed and like how we're going to update our protocols for that? We can't just assume that autonomous vehicles are going to come into our cities and we don't need new roles to deal with that. You know, we do need to be doing some updating on that. So that would be kind of on my wish list. And I think, you know, definitely 10 years from now, hopefully that will feel like, oh, that conversation is happening in cities in the way that the housing conversation is happening more now.
I did a piece of work years ago, ended up not really going anywhere, but it was around, could you charge for access to the curb? So we spoke to delivery companies, we spoke to municipalities, we spoke to Uber drivers. It was really like one of the delivery companies, and I can't mention the name, but they basically said, we pay X million dollars in parking tickets in New York City every day. And we're quite happy to pay to access, like, we just accept that's the cost of doing business. We'd rather we weren't paying tickets. So if the city came along and said, you can park here, you can't park here, and it's reasonable, we'll pay to, if our driver needs to stop outside that building for 6 minutes, we'll pay quite a lot of money per minute to stop there. And the city was like, well, if only we could map it. And the tech company was like, well, we can map it. And it never came off, but it was really interesting how people were recognizing if, but it still takes a coordinating force to make it happen. Yeah. So it's a really interesting one that you bring up. I like to end these on, if I gave you a magic wand, so ignore reality, ignore sort of like the sort of day-to-day restrictions. And if you're sort of free to have a wish or a command to make cities better places, what would you do with your magic wand?
Probably make urban public education the envy of, like, American urban publication, the envy of the world. I feel like that would transform everything in the U.S. If our urban public schools were better funded, better, you know, staffed, had better buildings, etc. Like, I just think that would change everything. And I think that would be my magic wand. Yeah.
You know how people always go, like, oh, I want to go to business school. I feel like there's a sort of, how do I go to urbanism school thing earlier on. So it's not, it feels like it gets relegated when it should have that sort of, you should want to do that more. So I really like that one. That's one of my favorite magic wand responses.
Oh, good, good.
Diana, I could go on all day, but like, you've been a joy to have a chat to today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks. This is great.
I'll put a link to the New Urban Order when we share this, because your writing is fantastic. So just appreciate you coming on and having a chat for an hour.
Well, thank you so much. This was awesome. I really enjoyed it, and getting to know you and talk about all this stuff. We should do it more often.
We'll do it again. I keep saying this, we need to do like sort of follow-up episodes. So we'll get to that in a future season. Okay. Thank you once again for listening all the way through to the end of one of these episodes. And you probably did catch at the end there, I completely misunderstood what Diana was saying about urban education. So if you read this in the Substack, you'll see that when I listened to it back, I was like, Diana means better public schools. I had it in my head of, we could make an urbanism school that's as desirable as business school. Maybe both those ideas are good. Anyway, my bad for misunderstanding that right at the end there. Anyway, once again, thank you so much for listening to another one of these episodes. Please do give it a like, a share, get in touch, and we'll see you again very, very soon. Thank you very much. Goodbye.